This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Folks, it is time to talk about one of my absolute favorite topics, snacks. Japanese snacks, specifically. You know, ever since I was a young lad who discovered the world of Japanese snacks, I've been obsessed with their adorable packaging, quirky vibes, and the incredible flavors that you just cannot find in U.S. supermarkets. That is why teaming up with our sponsor, Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been an absolute blast. Because these snacks aren't just your average grocery store finds. Every month, Boxu delivers over 20 unique treats straight from Japan. Plus, they include a handy guide filled with info about each snack and Japanese culture. Snacking and learning, literally my two favorite things, and I'm going to take a wild guess that those are two things you enjoy as well. Oh, and did I mention that each box ships free from Japan straight to your doorstep? It's incredible. And these snacks are so special, okay? One of them that I just cannot get out of my mind, they have this white chocolate strawberry. It's like a freeze-dried strawberry that is somehow injected with white chocolate. So it is both simultaneously strawberry and white chocolate. I cannot even describe to you what this tasted like. I have never had a textural or taste sensation like it. You gotta try it. And my favorite thing about Boxu, besides the amazing snacks, is that they support small, family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced your treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love Japanese snacks as much as I do, or if you know someone who does, you have got to try out Boxu. Right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. And let me know what you think of that strawberry. It is seriously good.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover. Thank you for joining me once again here on YouTube or on your favorite podcast player as I talk to an incredible expert about all the amazing things that they know that I don't know and that you might not know. Today, we're going to be talking about computer history. And if you're worried that this is just going to be some geeks nerding out about hardware, well, it will partially be that. But in addition to that, we are going to be telling the story about how we got the relationship that we do with computers. How did they become omnipresent in our lives? How did they end up being something that almost everybody in this country uses every single day? And you know, the journey of a billion clicks can begin with a single product launch, but it might not be the product launch that you think. Because the story that we often tell is that our lives were transformed by the smartphone, right? In the early aughts. But in fact, the smartphone is just the latest chapter of the story of our evolving relationship with these computing machines. Before there was a supercomputer in your pocket, there had to be a computer that anyone could use, that wasn't just used by big business people or scientists with a giant mainframe, right? We had to have our 0-to-1 moment where the computer became truly personal. And the computer that did that was the Apple II. Decades and decades before the launch of the iPhone, the Apple II was a revolutionary product that changed how people related to computers, as our guest today is going to explain. But before we get to that interview, I just want to remind you that if you want to support this show and keep getting these episodes, help keep them free for all the people around the world who listen to them and watch them, please support the show on Patreon. You can head to patreon.com/Adam Conover. Just $5 a month gets you every episode of this show ad-free. Plus, you can join our community. We would love to have you there. And if you like stand-up comedy, please come see me on tour this year. If you live in Buffalo, Baltimore, St. Louis, or Providence, Rhode Island, I'm going to be coming to your city. Head to adamconover.net for tickets and tour dates and to see where else in the country I'm going. Now let's get to today's interview. My guest today is Lane Nooney. They're a historian of technology and a fascinating writer, as well as an assistant professor of media industries at New York University and the author, most recently, of The Apple II Age, How the Computer Became Personal. I know you're going to love this conversation. Please welcome Lane Nooney. Lane, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Adam.
Okay, so look, I grew up in the 80s and 90s. I remember when I was a kid, the computer lab in my elementary school was full of these weird, slightly old computers. I knew they were slightly old at the time. They had green, like, phosphor displays or whatever. We mostly used them to play the Oregon Trail and get our wagon stuck in the river over and over again. Calk or Ford. I would always calk. Fording was a bad idea. Little did I know when I was a little kid using that computer that not only was I using one of the most important technological innovations of the century, but I would be here on my own podcast talking about this very model of computer some 30 years later. Why did you write a book about the Apple II and what was so important about it?
So the Apple II is maybe one of the unsung personal computers of the moment that invention really arises in America in beginning, you know, in the late 70s and through the early 80s. For me, trying to tell the history of computing, particularly of personal computing, I wanted a lever, right? There's so many different types of computers. There's so many different ways that people use them. And the Apple II was this sort of what I call an optimal historical object. It was a computer that was so widely used in both workplaces, homes, and as you mentioned, schools. There was so much software made for it that in the diversity of everything that people did for it, I could really produce a portrait of all the different ways that people used computers. So while the book is called The Apple II Age, in many ways, it's more about the software that was produced for the Apple II rather than the hardware itself.
And that does make sense to me because at the time, like, you know, every computer lab also had that box of floppies right next to it, or the computer teacher, or maybe just the English teacher who was a nerd had a box of floppies and be like, you got to check this out. You know, you got to play Number Munchers and then your mind will be blown or whatever it was, you know. There were like a treasure box of all these strange and wonderful things you could do with the computer. But hold on, there were computers before the Apple II that one could buy and bring into one's home, right? And there were computers that, you know, look today far more like the computers that we use today. You know, like, for instance, the first Macintosh, like, has more in common in terms of its user interface with the modern Macintosh than the Apple IIe or Apple II or Apple IIe does. So what is it that made that one moment so incredible with the Apple II? What was the special feature of that computer that caused this to all come together?
The Apple II is released in 1977, and in that's a really special year in the history of computing because it's the year that, you know, that's really the first year that personal computers become commercial products. There's two other really important personal computers that get released during that year. There's the TRS-80, which was Radio Shack's computer, which anyone who remembers an Apple II might also remember a Radio Shack computer.
And it's incredible, by the way, that Radio Shack, the company that by the time I was like old enough to know what it was, just sold like remote control cars and batteries and then became a joke and no longer exists, actually played a foundational role in computer history. It's like often forgotten. Just this brick and mortar store.
So the TRS-80 was actually the most popular personal computer when it first came out. It sold more than the Apple did. And it would do that basically up until about 1980. And that was when the Apple started to be a more successful product. But so you've got the Apple II, the TRS-80, the Commodore PET, all of these release in 1977. And that really becomes identified as the year that personal computing is like put on the shelf for an American consumer. And then from there, this whole kind of industry basically takes off overnight, right? You never had, there was no precedent for what anyone was trying to do in this industry. No one had ever sold software. Like, what did that mean for software to be sold in a store? What did it mean to own a store that sold computers or software to a consumer public. Certainly there were businesses like this that sold computers and software like B2B style, right?
Yeah.
To businesses, IBM, and corporations.
Sure.
Yeah. But this idea that suddenly we were going to sell computers to people and they were going to use them in their homes or their small businesses, they invented an industry overnight. And I think that was one of the things I really wanted to start with, that story of like, how did this happen? How did software become something that we go into a store and buy, right? What's that story? And for me, I think the Apple II tells that story in a really broad and expansive way.
Yeah. And let's just talk about for a second, what is the importance of telling this story? Because look, I mean, there's plenty of YouTube videos about technology history for a niche audience, just, you know, the enthusiast, hey, I'm curious about reading about any of these computers. But, you know, we're talking about it on this show because it feels like it has a broader importance. And I assume that's why you wrote about it. So what is the importance of doing this history?
Absolutely. So a lot of the technology stories that we might get on YouTube or on a computer documentary or that we might find on the internet are really narrow in a lot of senses. They're kind of about the hardware. They're about the primary inventors. They're about schematics and how, you know, how much memory did it have? You know, how fast was the computer? And to me, I'm like, you know, knowing the fact that Steve Jobs helped design the Apple II doesn't tell us anything about why the Apple II was important, right? It doesn't tell us anything about how culture changed. And so what I wanted to do with this book was attempt to tell that story. How did people's lives become computerized? And that's a story where you have to look at something besides the hardware itself or the famous quote unquote pioneers or these boy geniuses who wrote the software, made the hardware. You have to look at how did people use this stuff? What sold? Why did people buy it? What kind of purposes were people trying to figure out how to let a computer into their life? What did that mean? Circa 1980.
Yeah, that is so cool. And I really connect with that because a little bit of history for me is, you know, I was born in the early 80s, but my grandfather was he was a telephone engineer. He worked for AT&T his entire life. He was really into this period of personal computers. And specifically, he was fixated on Atari, which most people think of as a video game company.
Yep.
But he was really into their line of PCs.
Yes.
And he gave me, as a kid, a used Atari 800 XL that was many years out of date, but he had like found it in a dumpster and like, you know, gave it to me and then also gave me a bunch of cartridges, a basic cartridge and a stack of magazines of these magazines called Antic and Analog. And this is different from Apple, but I think it was the same sort of enthusiast market. It was people who were buying computers and then they needed somebody to tell them, well, what do you do with it? Like what sort of fun can you have with your computer? And so these magazines, the best thing is they would have source code in them and it would be like, hey, guess what? Here's a, I don't know, you want to program a kitchen timer? You want to program a game? You want to program something to help you do your taxes or whatever? Here's some source code that you could type in. Here's how to save it on a floppy disk, et cetera. It wasn't like a prosumer thing. This was for average people to do, but it was this sort of like collective effort to answer the question, this technology is so cool. What the hell do we all do with it? And so I felt like I got to participate in that a couple of years late because I was given it all by my grandfather. It was like a real flourishing of a culture around these computers, I think is the cool thing about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what winds up happening really quickly is that kind of thing that you're describing becomes a kind of computer hobbyism.
Yeah.
But what a lot of people very quickly figure out is that owning a computer is difficult. It's annoying. It's frustrating. It doesn't live up to its promise. And I don't want to learn to program to make it useful.
Uh-huh,
and I think because so much computer history has largely been told by programmers, engineers, hobbyists, people who grew up programming, people who have a lot of nostalgia about this time period, I think we forget that like most consumers, what they actually wanted was a computer they did not have to think about at all.
Right.
And that was the real struggle. And especially because computers at this time, you had to have a fairly substantial minimum competency in order to be able to operate one. But every piece of every software manufacturer and publisher was trying to figure out, how do we make the dead easiest thing that we possibly can?
Right.
Because there was not a vision that everyone was going to program, and most people thought it was super fucking annoying.
Yeah, it's true. My grandfather was in fact an engineer, and I had a little bit of that gene. I've always felt myself in between an enthusiast and a, you know, I used to code JavaScript, you know what I mean? But I'm not doing that now. Like when I'm trying to figure out, I like to do hobbyist stuff with my computer, but once I need to like write a shell script, I'm out, you know? And so I have my limit, and so does everybody. And most people's limits are way lower than mine. So presumably, I think then you must believe that the Apple II was some kind of answer to this question, that it did hit more people than just that sort of core hobbyist programmer base.
Absolutely. So the in 1977, the Apple II was the most expensive of those three computers I talked about a little bit ago, but that's because it kind of had the best specs. It was really designed to be a system that was expandable. And that was built into the engineering. The guy who engineered it, Steve Wozniak, who was a kind of brilliant, you know, a brilliant computer designer. What he wanted was a machine that, you know, you could, they could really grow with you. And so that made it really expensive at the start, which is why it sold slow. But over time, those other two systems, the TRS-80, the Commodore PET, they weren't designed with the, you'd have to replace them way too soon.
Mm.
And so Wozniak did this really, really smart thing, which was that, you know, you if you wanted to expand the memory of the computer, of the Apple II, you could just replace the RAM, right? You could upgrade the computer on your own.
This is so funny because this is the number one thing you cannot do with Apple products now, that they have almost entirely removed, except the very high end of their range with the Mac Pro towers and stuff. You can't upgrade their systems at all. And a lot of people do feel like they need to replace their Macs every 2 years or so if they don't configure them correctly at the start.
Absolutely. The history of early Apple is antithetical to the Apple we understand today.
Incredible.
Right? I mean, it came out of a supreme love of tinkering, of engineering, and a belief that people should be empowered to understand how their own systems work, right? Like the thing that Apple turned into really quickly under, like, you know, Steve Jobs and the Apple Macintosh is unrecognizable from the place where that computer company started, you know?
Yeah, but Steve Jobs, you mentioned the brilliance of Steve Wozniak. And by the way, I don't want to fall into the great man trap here and just talk about how great these two guys are. But Steve Jobs was brilliant at something, right? And I assume, all right. Well, what was his role in this story? He, for a person to have been around for the Apple II and the Mac and the iPhone and the iPod and all this, it must show that there's something to it, right? So how do you tell his role in the story? What does he do?
So Steve Jobs is, in terms of his role in this story, you know, the talent that Steve Jobs had was in trying to figure out how to commercialize the talent of Steve Wozniak.
Aha!
And I think that should really be understood as what Steve Jobs' role is.
Yeah.
Everyone from that period agrees he was not a superb engineer. He did not have a significant role in engineering the machine itself. He actually disagreed with Wozniak on some key elements. He lost those battles about things like the number of expansion ports that were going to be on the system. And he was dead. Jobs was dead wrong. And the reason this machine was a success was because Wozniak got his way.
I love
this. One of the things that probably the key role that Jobs played was that he was responsible for the industrial design. So the look of the case, he cared a lot about what the machine looked like in a store.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and I mean, I think that's something that makes sense to anyone who, you know, kind of loves the look and feel properties of Apple products.
I mean,
you know,
I can picture the Apple II. I can picture it under my, like, you know, the experience of putting my hands on it as a kid. It like has stuck with me as a piece of industrial design.
So he hired a guy named John Manock to do that, to engineer the case, the kind of plastic shell for it. And it was a very innovative piece of design as well, because the Apple II, I don't know, you probably never got to do this if you used one in school, but you could just lift the lid right off. There were no screws, right? There were no bolts. You could actually take the lid off and put your hands inside your own machine. And that was all part of Wozniak's design. But yeah, Jobs was...
That is a tinkerer's machine. That is truly for tinkerers.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that was a big part of why so many... So Wozniak also kind of released a lot of the documentation for how to make software for the machine. Mm. So that led developers to the machine. Mm-hmm. Apple never tried to take kind of third-party royalties or to interfere with the development of a third-party software market. And so that attracted developers to the machine.
Right. Again, unlike today, where now they lock down the App Store. You need Apple's approval to release anything for their computers or phones.
And they're going to take a 30% cut no matter what, right? Like, regardless of
but
whether
back then,
they had...
It was like, hey, do you want to start a software game company in your garage and make software for our computers? Go nuts. And a lot of people got started that way, created a flourishing in that way.
And so that's what makes the Apple II really popular. They attract a ton of developers. And so there's basically, by 1982, the Apple II has the largest software library of any computer on the market. I think it's around 2,000 pieces of software, which is a lot, you know, in 1982. Ownership was still in the single digits for personal computers at that time. Mm. And that was what gave the system so much longevity. And it was also where you could see the widest array of possible uses were made available for the Apple II. And that's kind of my argument, is that this machine is special because it showed us everything that people either did or imagined they might do with a computer.
So what sort of things were people doing? I mean, and what was the difference from before the Apple II to after? How did our uses of computers transform because of this?
I mean, so there kind of were no uses of computers before this, right? I mean, and Apple allowed you to kind of do the most because it was such a robust machine. But the way I divided my book was I look at these different categories of software that emerge in the late 70s, and then I look at a specific case study for each. So business software becomes a thing. And so this is where we get VisiCalc, the first spreadsheet, right? Like if you use Excel or Google Sheets, what you have to thank is a lineage that goes back to 1979, when the first automatic spreadsheet or digital spreadsheet or digital blackboard is invented.
And VisiCalc, it's often called, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's often called like the first killer app for computers, period. That this, the idea of a spreadsheet at all, of this sort of very malleable, adjustable calculator that you can use to make any formula you want be calculated, people were, especially business people, were just like, holy shit, I gotta have this right away. It was like a craze.
Yeah, the killer app hypothesis is, you know, the argument that this was the software that sold the Apple II. You know, historians can debate the exact accuracy of that. I mean, it would have. What do I want to say about that? It probably sped up the adoption of the Apple II. By some period of time, mm-hmm. I suspect that it would have happened no matter, you know, it was probably likely to happen no matter what. But, you know, it was the case that VisiCalc attracted a class of people to using a computer who never would have before, which was white collar businessmen. They had no, they had no interest in owning a computer. What they wanted was what VisiCalc could do. And they would walk into a computer stores and they would just say, I want a VisiCalc machine. They didn't even know it was an Apple. They didn't care. Right. What they knew was that there was one computer that ran this one piece of software and they had to have it. And one of the funny accounting things they would do is basically buy a desk that had a $10,000 computer sitting on it so that they could write it off against their businesses, you know?
So what other, I mean, so I think you feel probably that VisiCalc was important. Maybe it did not make or break the entire computer industry as sometimes promoted, but what were the other uses that people were buying Apple IIs for at this time that emerged?
So, you have business software, you have game software, which is really about highlighting the novelty of what you can do with a computer. You have software like utilities that are programming languages, stuff for the hardcore hobbyists who want to learn how to, you know, want to maximize their use of their computer. You have home software. Do you remember the print shop? Did you ever use that in school?
I do remember the print shop. Is this, well, you tell me, but I think I know what it is.
What do you think it is?
I think it was the thing where you could print out the big banner that said Happy Halloween that the guy who ran the computer lab could print out, and then they could put in the entryway to the elementary school.
Yes, yes.
And it had like a pumpkin and a bat.
That was one of the most successful, iconic pieces of software ever released in the 1980s. It's totally been forgotten. I wrote a whole chapter about it. I dug up the two guys who made it. I was like the first. I had to track them down almost quite literally to find these men. They had just disappeared.
Wow.
And you know, education software, that was a huge thing. There was so much anxiety in the 1980s about what is the role of America in the global competitive marketplace? Are we being competitive enough, especially with Japan? There was a lot of Japanophobia during this time, a lot of anxiety about other nations' kids, you know, lapping U.S. children. And the idea was that the computer was going to make our children more competitive, right? That was, there was a whole thing in that. Word processors also, you know, I don't write about them much in the book, but because other people have written work on word processors, but that was also a huge area of consumer interest.
I mean, to go from writing on a typewriter, a manuscript on a typewriter where you can write it once, or, you know, you got your white out or maybe your ability to remove some of the letters or whatever, but you're basically writing in a single string, to being able to random access, go to any point in your document and insert new text. Just that changed the way people were able to write, to have that ability.
Typically, if you were a male executive, you weren't on a typewriter anyway. You were handwriting everything, giving it to your secretary, and she would type it.
Right. Or dictating.
One of the funny things was that typing was considered secretarial. So when men bought computers, one of the things they had to buy alongside of it was typing instruction software, because none of them knew how to type. They understood typing to be a kind of a women's labor. And so there were all these guys who like suddenly had to learn how to keyboard because they had never learned that as a skill before.
It's also very funny that typing is something it's even funny to think now that typing is something that we have to teach, because now everyone just types all the time. But I remember being a kid and being in that Apple II lab, and they made us practice typing tests. And I thought it was stupid because I already could type because we had a computer at home, blah, blah, blah. But you know, you're doing the home row and everything. And like, lo and behold, thank God they taught all the kids how to type, because it's literally all anybody does all day now is type.
I mean, are they still taught how to type? I'm not sure. It's like, they all swipe now. I don't know what's going on.
We might know already.
You know?
I just want to return to the print shop briefly, because that piece of software, completely iconic. First of all, because they would print the banners on the printer was part of the very important, was part of this revolution. The fact that, first of all, you could type something on your computer and then output as many copies as you want right in front of you is like a big deal, you know, desktop publishing and all that. But also, just the fact, first of all, that the printers went extremely memorable, and that the paper was connected. Why don't we have this today? What they had back then was the paper would come in a giant sheaf, and they would all be connected like an accordion, and so you could print out a 100-foot-long banner. Where can I get that paper today at Office Max? They don't make those printers anymore.
I think you can order it kind of off-market from China. It still exists somewhere, but it's not easy to find.
But we all had the power in the early 80s to print out a 100-foot-long banner anytime we needed one, and today we have lost it. And I think we've gone backwards. Do you agree?
I think the loss of the print shop banner is a grave disappointment.
Incredible. Well, on that note, let's take a really quick break. We're going to come back and talk a lot more of the incredibly fun history of the Apple II with Lane Nooney. Folks, I'm honored to say that the podcast is sponsored this week by The Washington Post. If you're a Factually listener, you're already a person who aims to stay informed, aware, and engaged. But let me bring you in on a little secret. Beside the fantastic guests I have on this show, the number one way that I stay engaged is through reading the news like The Washington Post. Their journalists bring you the facts and provide clarity about what's happening on Capitol Hill, the economy, climate change, foreign policy, and everything else that I and you care about. You know, here on Factually, we love to go deep on topics, and The Washington Post helps me and helps you go deeper on the news that matters most to you.
That's why I start my days by warming up my brain by reading great articles from some of the best journalists out there in the Post. In fact, many of my favorite past guests on this show, like Taylor Lorenz and David Weigel, have contributed to the Washington Post. That's how good their journalists are. You know, I've also found that adding the Washington Post app to the home screen on my phone has been a great way to cut my social media time. Instead of scrolling through social media on the bus, I get to learn more about the world around me. It is absolutely incredible and makes that commute time so much more enjoyable and fruitful. I also love the Post's newsletters, like The 7, which is a quick commute read that they send each weekday morning and is also available as a podcast. I even signed up to get the Post's For You newsletter, which sends me my very own personalized roundup of stories every evening based on my interest in reading history. So if all of that sounds good to you, well, now is the time to sign up for The Washington Post. Go to WashingtonPost.com/factually to subscribe for just 50 cents a week for your first year. That is 80% off their typical offer. So this is truly a steal. Once again, that is WashingtonPost.com/factually to subscribe for just 50 cents a week for your first year. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. You know, I never used to have allergies, but then suddenly in my 30s, I started getting walloped with them every single spring. I'll step outside on a beautiful day, ready to hop on the bus or head down to the podcast studio, and suddenly I have a runny nose, scratchy eyes, and it makes it pretty hard to have a conversation with our guests when I am so bogged down and distracted with allergies. Well, luckily for those of us who live with those symptoms, which now includes me, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. So when I've got a big interview with a big guest, I look for relief with Claritin D. In as little as 30 minutes, I'm refreshed, I'm renewed, and I no longer sound like some kind of cartoon duck. So if you are ready to live life as if you don't have allergies, it is time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. You can find Claritin D at your pharmacy counter, and you don't even need a prescription. So go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. That's Claritin.com. Use as directed.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, we're back with Lane Nooney. I mean, tell me about, like, what made the Apple II so easy to use for people? We're talking again about the difference between the enthusiasts and the public, and how businessmen who didn't even know how to type were buying these machines. Was it really that big of a revolution in, like, usability for the average person?
Certainly, that really depended on your software.
Okay.
And so that, you know, whether or not your computer was hard or easy to use depended on how well made your software was. And Pritchop is a great example in this. One of the most frequent comments about the print shop, if you go back and read reviews from 1984, is how many people talk about how you never had to open the manual.
Wow.
That the software was intuitive, that a piece of software made in 1984, you just put the disc in, the whole thing came up, and it taught you what to do. And it was this play between, okay, you're going to have all of this creative potential, but you're also going to be really constrained. We're going to put you on a rail. You're going to choose things in an order. You're going to choose out of a limited set of options. And all of these things are going to, you know, you're going to get these choices one by one. This isn't a free for all. This isn't Photoshop. This isn't PageMaker, right? You know, we're going to show you step by step how you make that banner, how you make that greeting card for grandma, how you make that sign. And that was maybe one of the first times I think you could legitimately talk about something like user friendliness relative to using a computer. But that was really all in the software.
And like, who came up with that? I mean, you're talking, you know, Wozniak was like the ultimate tinkerer, right? And Jobs was at best a clever marketer. And they weren't telling the print shop guys what, you know, what kind of software to make. So what is it about the Apple II or about this moment that caused that change to occur, where previously, I mean, people were typing in probably command, you know, into command lines and programming BASIC and, you know, interacting with computers in much more complicated ways?
Well, I think by 1984, you actually had way too much software in the market. There was a big market crash that would happen after 84 because there was basically a huge bubble that hit. Everyone was producing too many products. There was the speculation about how big the market was going to get was way, way, way out of whack with reality. And so you knew that if you wanted to sell something, you couldn't just like churn out some kind of unbugged, crappy piece of software anymore. You had to cut through a lot of noise, and new users, the newer the user, the less tolerant they were to complexity.
Uh-huh.
So to expand the market, you had to make things simpler. And so the two guys who designed the print shop, they were at the time a gay couple, Marty Kahn and David Balsam. They met in San Francisco in the late 70s or early 80s.
Hell yeah.
And Marty Kahn worked as a graphics programmer, but he also had experience as a visual artist. He used his computer to make computer art. Some of the first computer art ever made for personal computers, in fact.
Wow. What kind of art did he make? Like what form did it take?
It was kind of like 3D modeling stuff, uh-huh. A little bit psychedelic, you know, but all of it was printed out just on these big sheets. And sometimes he would paint them in. He sent me a bunch of it. There's images of some of it in the book, but it's very classic kind of like, you know, like what do they call that? The 3D figure eight or the torus, right? These like common 3D modeling shapes.
Yeah.
That he was trying to work with.
But on an Apple or very early computers, that's really cool.
Yes. Yes. And so what they wanted was a piece of software that would create connections between people.
Mm.
That was really their goal. And their original prototype was the idea that you would be able to create a little interactive or a kind of visual experience on your computer, save it to a disk and give it to your friend. And their publisher, Broderbund, was like, this is cool, but it requires everyone to have the same piece of software. How often, you know, like, if everyone has to have an Apple II in order for this to make sense or to work. And someone at Broderbund basically asked them, what if you could print this out? What if instead of this thing being stuck to a screen, what if it became a physical experience? And I think that was a radical transformation in the idea. And what they were lucky about was that these two guys, David and Marty in particular, were good enough programmers, good enough at graphics, that they could actually pull that off, that they could figure out how to design the system to do that.
Yeah.
And usability was their number one goal. It was like, we want a child to be able to use this,
wow.
Right? As you remember, right? Early reviews, there's one that just says, this is not a game, right? And the reviewer's being sardonic because she's like, it feels like a game. That's how fun it is to use this program. You know,
that's amazing. By the way, I love hearing some of the queer history of early computing too. It's not often told enough. That's such a cool dimension to that story. But let's talk about games a little bit, my favorite topic, because look, I've been playing video games my entire life, and there are these two interesting parallel tracks of video games in the 80s of personal computer games and then, you know, Nintendo style console games that eventually converged and split. It's like such a cool way to follow it. Tell me about but this was certainly a period of incredible flowering in games where people were discovering new ways that you could play with a computer. How important were games to the Apple II, and what new discoveries were made at that time?
I mean, one of the things that if you do an analysis of sales is like nobody bought a computer to play games, but
that's not what they told each other.
everyone who owned a computer bought games.
Yes.
And so they were no one's primary rationale, right? Yeah, you couldn't substantiate the cost, right? Computers were way more expensive than a game console.
Yeah.
Way more expensive than, you know, having a video game arcade addiction playing Pac-Man down at the arcade every day.
Mm-hmm.
They were really expensive, complicated hardware. So, but everyone found a reason to own a little bit of game software, and every publisher, even VisiCalc, even their publisher, you know, originally also released games. Like everybody also released games,
yeah,
because they were this, you know, games were not used, they were consumed. And so there was this ravenous kind of appetite in the market to for whatever you could find next.
Yeah, you always need a new one.
Yeah, you always, right, as soon as, because either you get bored or a lot of what is happening is that every single person programming game software is trying to figure out how to outdo the person who just released something else,
uh-huh,
right? So it's in games where I say that, like, one of my theories is that game software is really the only kind of software whose whole goal is to try and manipulate the limitations of hardware. Like the kind of spirit of a game is to make a computer do something it shouldn't be able to do.
Yes.
And that holds true even today.
Oh yeah. You know? I mean, when people talk about the new Zelda game, which I am still playing after 100 hours, a lot of it is like, how the hell did Nintendo get this piece of hardware from like basically 2015 to run a perfect physics simulation with all these moving objects that you can combine in any way? It never glitches out. Everything is physics interactable. You're playing it and you're like, I cannot, this must be the best programmers in the world who did this.
Yeah.
But that's exactly the same thing as someone looking at, you know, an early PC going like, how can I squeeze a couple extra colors out of this, or squeeze,
yes,
just a little bit of, you know, a little bit extra firepower.
How do I put graphics on a text adventure, right?
Right.
How do I solve that problem? How
right.
do I make those graphics color? How do I make them interactive? How do I make a sprite? And then how can I do many of those things maybe at the same time? And so it's in games that you get these marvelous feats of kind of virtuosic engineering, right? Because it's not just about trying to get a product to do a thing, or to, you know, be useful or fit on the floppy disk. It was about a culture of young programmers dominantly trying to outdo one another. There was a tremendous amount of gamesmanship. There was also one of the most popular kind of quote unquote genres was arcade ripoffs. In the very early years, kind of, you know, 1980, 1981, a lot of the games that were released were programmers looking at what their favorite arcade games were and trying to make a perfect knockoff. And they, you know, there would be all of these different kind of, you know, whether it was, a Donkey Kong-like or a Galaga-like or a Space Invaders-like. It didn't take long for Atari to come after a bunch of these companies. By 81, they were definitely filing lawsuits trying to get them to knock this off. So that dried up pretty quickly. But it's also in computers we get types of games that you can't get on a console or
yes.
an arcade, right? Games that are kind of, you get the role-playing game, right? You get the strategy game. Something like Flight Simulator, right, just isn't suited to the economic or programming model of a console or an arcade. And so, yeah, we get unique new genres that also appear for computers.
Yeah, and one of the coolest things about this period in games, and I think about this all the time, is that, you know, by the time Nintendo, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s, that was marketed as a toy. And it was marketed to kids and almost entirely to boys. So it was very narrow, and that sort of shaped the kind of game that was being made. But if you look at the games that came out for the PC market starting in the 80s and through to the 90s, this culture still existed. Games were for all types of people. You had games made by and made for adults and for women. And, you know, you had people like Roberta Williams, you know, who created, the King's Quest series for Sierra, you know, and originally Mystery House, like in the very early days, and like created an entire game company. And a lot of the games she made were if not marketed directly for women, they certainly included women in their marketing, because computers were this sort of product product for everybody. You know, companies like Infocom making these like extremely literary text adventures where the whole appeal was like, it's like playing a novel, which is something that I love video games so much that leached out of the culture of video games so quickly. And it's still not really there, you know, that games are being made for 50-year-old novel readers. You know what I mean? And it's a bummer. It's a bummer. It's something that like there was a lot of possibility in that space of who could make games and who could play games. It was wide open in a way it wasn't 15 years later.
Yeah, it's a really funny thing about computer game history is that even though computers, you know, were coded as kind of male objects, and in many cases that kind of demographically played out that way, there was just, I think, a broader imagination of who was using them, what entertainment was.
Yeah.
And what really kills that, it's not quite Nintendo, it's Nintendo versus Sega.
Uh-huh.
It's the hyper-competitive... it's basically the first time we get a console war. And what Sega does is they stop appealing to that 8 to 11 or 8 to 12 year old demographic that Nintendo has locked down. And instead, Sega goes after a slightly older boy teenager.
Yeah.
And so that's where it becomes about sexualization. It becomes about violence. It becomes right. about video
Sega!
Games being, yeah, Sega, you know, it becomes about like video games being a place to escape your mom or your yeah. grandma or to get away from women, which yeah. if you think about it, is like so fucked up.
Yeah.
And it's kind of
that was literally in the marketing
of a whole bunch of our problems, right?
Yeah.
Is that like young men were sold this idea that games are where you become masculine, like it, you know, and I think it grokked the culture for decades.
Yeah. And it's just bizarre again, because I also played games like King's Quest, right? One of which
yes.
was
yeah,
had like a female lead, and you're a princess, and you're trying to rescue the prince, and you know it's like a fairy tale. And these were games that I loved, right? This was like
King's Quest 4. Yeah,
and this was a direction that we could have gone maybe further in games culture. And you can look at it as a path not taken, or you can look at it as a path that was taken that we forget too easily.
But
I'm curious, you know, as we sort of try to reach the end of this interview and think about this in a broader way, there were a lot of choices that were made by people like Wozniak, Jobs, and, you know, other folks at that time that shaped what we think a computer could be and who it's for, just as happened with video games. So what were some of those choices, and what were the roads that we didn't take? Are there any possibilities that were foreclosed that, you know, you wish we might have gone down?
Oh God, that's a good question. I'm maybe the way that I would approach this, and if you don't like this answer, you can just cut me, you know. But like the way that I would approach this would be kind of about it would actually be about kind of the way we've continued to only remember the computer as a certain kind of thing.
Mm.
And I think that that has actually done damage to the kinds of futures we imagine computers can make. Mm. That when we only tell the history of a computer as this thing that's about its hardware and it's about its boy genius inventors, or it's a thing that, you know, has such a kind of limited sense of relevance, right? You know, those really long YouTube teardowns that are going to talk about every memory, you know, RAM spec and everything.
Sure.
That all have the same voice, you know, like there's that just computer man voice, you know, from these YouTube videos. when we think that that's all that computing is, right? I've actually gotten some interesting, you know, some interesting complaints that my book is not appropriately demonstrative or praiseworthy of people like Steve Jobs.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, if you think that the whole point of history is just to like praise these dudes, then where can we go from there?
Yeah.
Right? Because history is the fuel from which we imagine the future histories we're trying to make, right?
Yeah.
Like people, there's a reason that Jobs is a totem. There's a reason that he is supposed to be this source of inspiration. And when I think when we fail to realize what these things were in their fullest context, then we don't actually understand what made computing important at all.
Yeah.
And then that kind of ruins our ability to create anything new, right? We just wind up on this awful treadmill that we're all living in right now, where like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg are having a cock measuring match over what, you know, like what's even happening here? You know, this idea that everyone has to kind of like rule the territory or be in total control, and we just that it's all about like who's the master of the market. I don't know. It just seems like there's nothing like where's a history of computing or of any of this social media or anything that is like emphasizes, I don't know, like people's essential dignity, their interest in collaborating and communicating.
Yeah.
You know, we've turned these into weird stories about like men needing to one up each other or dudes being geniuses. And it's just sad because I think it limits what we imagine the future of technology could actually be to just a limited set of kind of, you know, narcissistic stories.
Well, I mean, story is the operative word there, right? Because, you know, the sort of stories we like to tell are one man versus another man and they fight. And, you know, that's just, that's mythology. That's legend. You know, that's sort of the structure of storytelling itself. It lends itself towards that kind of story, but not exclusively that kind of story. There are other, you know, the kind of story I like is the story where we go underneath that lazy story we've heard a million times and we discover something new under there. And so what is the thing you've discovered about this time in history and about this computer? You say it's not just about the great men and it's not just about the domination of the marketplace and it's not just about the hardware. What is it about this time? Is it about what one thing I've loved hearing you talk about is the community that grew up around it. Is it about that or what is it for you?
I think for me, it's the constant reminder that no one was demanding this. Mm. Like actually the market, like the and I guess we didn't talk about this a ton in this interview, but that the capital invest, like that corporate investments, basically venture capitalists, investors, things like that, were really really needed a new market to take off in the early 1980s. And they spent a lot of time convincing people that computers were a thing that they needed. And I, for me, that's been such a beautiful reveal on the idea that in many ways, these desires were like ardently manufactured by people with core economic investments, which isn't to say computers wouldn't have taken off or that they wouldn't have been important, but the kind of bubble of interest we see emerge in the late 70s, early 80s is really about a set of kind of elite investor interests kind of trying to brute force market potential. And I think of that every time I hear someone show, you know, every time someone tried to tell me the metaverse is the future or crypto is the future, or it's just like, we have to stop saying that things are inevitable because they're not.
Yeah.
They're so not. And like, I've got all the receipts to prove that they're not.
But just to push back very slightly, because I absolutely believe in the existence of companies manufacturing markets like that. And, you know, when I see these new things that are being pushed, like the metaverse or, you know, the Apple goggles or whatever, I'm like, that's not going to improve my life. Like, I'm sitting here, if I buy all this shit, I'm going to be in the same position I was before, right? I'm not excited. Except that back in the dawn of the computer age, I was so excited, right? Like, I know that the money had to be put in, but, you know, when I think about my early interactions with the internet, when I finally had the opportunity to get on there and, like, interact with people, I was like, oh my God, I can do things I couldn't do before. Now, granted, life went on, you know, before that. So how do those things interact in your view?
Yeah. So I think the internet is a separate proposition. The internet, actually, personal computing, when it begins in the late 1970s, it never lived up to the promises of what it was going to do until the internet, until the early 90s. And so what you had basically in the 80s was this just slog of trying to find a reason to convince people that continual, because it isn't just enough for somebody to buy a computer.
Yeah.
You need them to buy new software.
Yeah.
You need them to actually replace that computer on a routine. And for most, like, yes, there were people who found computers fascinating.
Yeah.
A lot of people just didn't get it.
Sure. They
didn't
were like,
know why they needed it.
They're like, great, you can print a banner. Good. And thanks for the
it
banner.
It didn't improve anyone's lives, yeah. right? But also imagine that, like, the position to show these to a child is to do a certain kind of political work about teaching a child about what the future is supposed to look like.
Sure.
Right. I mean, there is a kind of shaping that's happening in that moment. The internet True. Is something, the internet sells the personal computer in a way that the personal computer could not sell itself.
Yes.
And I think that is bar none absolutely true. It was, but even in the 90s, and this is shocking to realize, even in the 90s, only a third of U.S. households had a personal computer.
Yeah.
Like it just was never actually, it was never actually the ubiquitous, it wasn't a television, it wasn't a radio, right? Which, you know, TV went from like 5 to 89% of U.S. households in a decade.
Yeah.
Right. Personal computing couldn't get a lock on that. Not a chance. And so I think this history has kind of undermined, I think, a lot of assumptions we have about the inherent popularity of computing that for me has been very useful in always just kind of thinking twice about what somebody wants to tell me about what the future is supposed to look like.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And you're making me appreciate A, that, you know, I was maybe a little bit more of a nerd enthusiast, right? Who was attracted to it. And I had a grandfather who taught me how to use it, which I'm grateful for. But also I was being worked on, you know, that I was,
yeah.
My grandfather was selling it to me as it was sold to him. And of course, my obsession with video games as a kid, I was drawn into the birth of this new medium, which I think is a wonderful artistic medium. I was also massively being marketed to. I subscribed to a magazine that told me about all the new games, and I keep those magazines in my house right now under lock and key because they're precious to me, because I was marketed to so effectively that being a Nintendo fan is like now part of my permanent personality, and I'm just stuck with that. So I absolutely believe I'm subject to it. But it's a really good point you raised about the internet, because I remember what really saved Apple, right? When it was on the brink of extinction, it was the iMac. It was, and what was the iMac? What was the i? It was internet. And how did they market it? They said it was the easiest way to get on the internet. Suddenly, yes. All these people, yes. Who were like, why do I need a computer? Were like, oh, I got to get on the internet. How do I do it? And it was, this is your easiest way. That was the famous Jeff Goldblum, there's no step three advertisement, right?
Yes. And so we see again the importance of actually not understanding how the computer works,
right,
as a prerequisite.
The advertisement said you won't need to know, yeah, how the Mac works. Just buy the fucking, yeah, thing and turn it on. Yep. Jeff Goldblum, yep, says it's going to work.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, man, it's so fascinating to talk to you about this stuff. I mean, what other insights does this give you about how we look at technology today? You said it helps you be more skeptical of, you know, when the metaverse and other things are being shoved down our throats by Zuck or whoever else. Does it give you any other vision of what the future of computing could look like to look at its past in this way?
You know, I like to take the historian's prerogative that I don't have to talk about the future.
Okay.
You know, like
okay.
I'm not sure there is some lesson that we're supposed to extract about, like, what, I don't know. I always find it odd that this is like a position we want to take about the past, that it's supposed to, like, I'm not sure there is some kind of kernel in here about, I mean, I think, huh, let me think about this for a second.
No, I mean, can I just say, I love this answer, because, yeah, I was asking you to help us arrive at a final point here, and you're setting me straight that the premise of the question is bullshit, right? Like, why am I asking you about the future? Why am I asking you what grand lesson to take away? Like, the pursuit of history is its own reward here, and it's a thing that's worth understanding. And so feel free to just tell me to go fuck myself and we can end the interview.
Yeah, I think that our desire to kind of make the history about the present all the time actually kind of robs it of something sometimes, right?
And I love this.
We miss kind of the point of just letting a thing be in the past and trying to understand it in the past. Mm-hmm. Are there ways, are there kind of capitalist lessons I can extract from that? Yes. Are there new ways, are there revived ways I think about, like, what is bullshit about how people want to sell us technology? Yes. But I think there's tremendous, like, beauty and poetry and all of the little tales that are wrapped up in this computer. And I think that we can enjoy them for their own sake without needing to make them about, like, us in a certain sense.
I mean, what a brilliant answer to my question. And it gives me such excitement to dive into this book. The name of the book, once again, is The Apple II Age. You can pick up a copy at our special bookshop at factuallypod.com/books. Lane, is there anywhere else that you would like to plug people to pick up a copy or where they can find your work?
Yeah, so you can find my work on my website, www.lanenooney.com. I'll have links to all of the many, many proliferating social media presences that I have up there, my tweets, toots, threads, etc. And if you want to get a copy of the book, you can also hit up my publisher at the University of Chicago Press. They currently have a little promo code UCPNEW. That'll get you 30% off a copy as well.
Oh my God. Go get it from the publisher and get that 30% off. Lane Nooney, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Adam, thank you so much for having me. This was fantastic.
My God, thank you once again to Lane Nooney for coming on the show. You can pick up a copy of their book at factuallypod.com/books. It supports both this show and your local bookstore as well. If you want to support this show directly, you can do so at patreon.com/Adam Conover. Just $5 a month gets you every episode of the show ad-free. For $15 a month, I will read your name and thank you on this very program. And this week, I would like to thank Kim Kepler, Trey Burt, MacGNG314, Patrick Ryan, My Own Avenger, and Shannon J. Lane. If you want to join them, patreon.com/Adam Conover. And thank you, as always, to the incredible community that powers this show. I'm making this show with you and for you, and I'm so grateful to all of you for being a part of it. If you want to follow me on tour, once again, adamconover.net for tickets and tour dates. I want to thank my producers, Sam Roudman and Tony Wilson, everybody here at HeadGum for making the show happen. You can find me online at Adam Conover or adamconover.net. See you next week on Factually.
That was a HeadGum podcast.